So I actually don't think there is an archetype. I think there are many that are blended together, which is what actually makes a really good CEO or leader, is that they aren't just one particular type of person. Otherwise, you can't ebb and flow when things come up. And if you can't ebb and flow, you'll drown.
It's easy to say the nonprofit sector is broken. Less easy is saying how we're going to fix it. Welcome to What Donors Want, a podcast by IG Advisors, where we speak with brilliant people to reimagine the future of social impact. In this fourth season, we'll be switching things up a bit and diving into what we all want, including and beyond donors. I'm Rachel Stephenson-Scheff, IG's Managing Director, and we're a strategy consultancy specializing in social and environmental change. This podcast is part of our mission to fix the flow of resources for good. Welcome back to What Donors Want. I'm Rachel, IG's Managing Director and the host of the show, and today is all about leadership. I sat down with IG's chair, Alicia Fernandez-Miranda, and together we had the privilege of chatting with Farah Mohammed. Farah is a leader with over 25 years' experience in the government, social profit, and for-profit sectors. Currently, she's CEO of the King's Trust Canada, a charity that creates pathways to employment for barriered youth across the country. But you may also know her from her roles as CEO of the Malala Fund, founder and CEO of Girls 20, the decade she spent in the Canadian government, and all of those among many, many other preeminent leadership positions. We had an incredible conversation with her, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Leadership is something that we're very passionate about at IG and we think a lot about. So it's also worth flagging that we just launched a brand new program called Impact and Grow, a Leadership Lab. It's a six-week program to support changemakers to experiment, test, and level up their practical leadership skills, as well as their personal motivation and brand. If this sounds like something that's of interest to you or someone you know, applications are due on May 3rd, 2024, of course, and you can find out more details on our website, impactandgrowth.com. I'll put all the links in the show notes. Before we dive in, I just want to send a thank you and shout out to our official season 4 sponsor, Siegel Family Foundation, whose generosity and partnership makes this all possible. And also a big thanks to our fantastic media partner, Alliance Magazine. Check out their website, alliancemagazine.org, and you can get 50% off a subscription with the code WHATDONORSWANT, all one word, at checkout. All right, on to the conversation with Farah and Alicia. And let's start by saying, Farah, welcome to What Donors Want.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to start my morning with you guys and to get deep into these issues. And congratulations on all the different podcasts you guys have had so far. Thanks for adding me to the list.
Thank you. No, it's really our honor and our pleasure. So today is all about you and your career and your leadership experience and all the amazing things that you've done. You've really had such an incredible career and experiences across so many different thematic areas and countries and organization types. So I'm wondering, just to kind of set the scene for listeners, can you tell them about yourself, kind of paint the picture of your career journey so far and kind of give the story of who you are?
Sure. So I guess, who am I? I think the most important thing to know is that I'm a refugee to Canada. I was born in Uganda. Indian heritage, African born, raised in Canada with a Persian name. And so the best way to put that is that I'm a little bit of cultural chaos. But why that's important is because, you know, your background does really help raise you. It grows you, right? I was born to two people who left a country that they loved, and they came to Canada and learned to love this country. And so what is ingrained in me is a sense of debt and gratitude. And I think that's really what has shaped me in terms of taking on the challenges that I've had. I will say that I went to university and thought I was going to go and be a lawyer. And so I went to Queen's University and I loved it. And I decided that I was going to go do a master's instead of a law degree. And I fell in love with politics. And I got my first big break when Paddy Torsney, 31 years old, defeated a opposite member of the party for the first time in 20-something years. And I went to volunteer for her. And after the campaign was over, she won. I thought I was going to get a job. And so when she didn't give me the job, I wrote her a letter and said, "You've made a mistake. You should have hired me." And she said, "Go do your master's and we'll talk." And that was my first break. And so it was a really amazing sort of journey from, I really don't know what would have happened to me had I not come to Canada, but I will tell you that the opportunity to work in Canadian politics as a refugee is like, I think that is the cat's meow.
You gave us the beginning, right? But you've done so many extraordinary things across your career. And one of the reasons that I have always loved working with you is because you, like me, are a bridge builder, someone who has worked across different sectors and then been able to bring them all together and understand what the different levers are that are influencing people in the nonprofit world versus the business world versus that kind of government and public sector. So I know that you spent almost a decade working with Canadian politicians on Parliament Hill. How did this environment compare to some of the other working environments, particularly in some of the nonprofits that you have worked in?
Oh my God, that's such a loaded question. It's a great question. So first, Alicia, I'm going to say you and I met because, you know, you were one of the biggest supporters of Girls 20. And not just with dollars, with time. That's how we met. Remember, I won't mention where you were because maybe you don't want it mentioned, but
I've written an entire book about my life. Everybody knows everything about me now. So
but you were insightful and you were thoughtful and you were generous. But I think it was relationships like that that actually set me up for success on how do you actually bridge. But, you know, I guess the one thing I would say is the difference between government and the social profit. And you'll notice that I never use the word not for profit because I don't describe myself as not a man, not tall, not white. So I don't describe what I do as not something. But the social profit world and government are so different in some ways in that government is competitive and there's a winner, there's a loser, there's a zero-sum game. You know, lots of people go there for the right reasons. And that's where the similarities start. So government and social profit, you know, we're working towards something. We're working in service. And that's the most important element. But where it becomes different is, I think government and politics specifically is set up to be combative. And it doesn't need to be. The social profit world, while we're in competition for the dollar, there's a lot of collaboration. Because people understand that if you don't collaborate, you're out of the game. They are built so differently, yet they're all about service. They're all about providing something good to somebody else. Ideally, in government and in politics, it's your constituent. That's your shareholder.
Right.
And in the social profit world, you've got a shareholder also, and that is the client that you serve, the donors that help you serve those clients. So, you know, there are a couple things I would say is there's a sense of animosity, particularly now. You know, when I worked in government in 1995, actually, I started, there wasn't the sense of animosity and gotcha politics and terrible behavior as we see right now. And it is atrocious. And I will say that one of my best jobs was in government. And now I'm not sure that I would be able to hack it. In a social profit setting, yes, you're competitive. Yes, you don't get along with everyone. Everyone thinks, oh, it's kumbaya. No, actually, it's not kumbaya. It can be very competitive. But there's just something about people who work in the social profit where you set yourself aside. You're not the person on the ballot. You're not the person on the front door. You're actually working in service to other people. And that's why you get out of bed. So somewhere along the line, I think I worked for amazing politicians who never changed. They were never about themselves. They were never about only the party. But there's a fierce partisanship now that exists, and it is palpable and it's disgusting.
It's amazing how you see that across so many different countries. And this is not a political podcast, so we're not going to go all the way there here. But I do think this idea of public service, I feel like when I was growing up, that's what it was. You went into public service, and it doesn't always feel like that anymore.
No, and I won't get political either. And I'm not making comment about any one of our countries. I'm saying you're seeing it everywhere. You're feeling it. Young people don't want to vote. They don't like what they see. And that's what we should be worried about. You know, I don't really care about partisan politics the way that most people do. I'm a liberal. I'm happy to be a liberal. But it doesn't define who I work with. It doesn't define what I say. It doesn't define where I work. It doesn't define any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And for lots of people, it does. And that's I think, pretty sad.
Yeah. Speaking of different countries, and going back to what you said earlier, I love the term cultural chaos. Yeah. As you said, born in Uganda, raised in Canada as a refugee. We met in London when you were CEO of Malala Fund. So you've had this exposure and this experience in so many different cultures in different ways at different stages of your life. And now bringing it into this social profit sector, which I love. It's, you know, it's not the non-profit. I even think of that with
Help me get that to catch on. Okay. Like Yeah. Do a whole podcast.
We're going to make it happen.
I love it. Language matters. We need to be for something. What are we for? Not against. I think with atheism, I think there's an interesting parallel too.
Okay.
But anyway, this is not a religious podcast or a political one.
All we need to do is talk about people's age, and then we've like broken all the taboos.
Oh, we'll get there. We're going to talk about generational differences. Don't you worry. But now, speaking of this social profit sector, the social profit marketplace, if you will. And in, you know, particularly in Canada, where of course I'm from as well, and where you work now at Prince's Trust Canada and your experience in working in London, what would you say are the key differences or kind of key characteristics of the social profit markets around the world where you've worked or had experience?
I mean, I think a key characteristic, no matter where you work, is there's a sense of community. That's a really key characteristic that I think people forget. You're building community. And no matter what you do around social profit, one of the key differences in where you do it is sometimes, depending on what country you happen to be in, there is a paradigm of government. There is a paradigm of philanthropy in some that's greater than others. So in places like China and Russia, you have to really pay attention to what you're doing there as a social profit because government is very present. And there can be a lot of things you want to do that you don't do. Whereas in Canada or Mexico or Brazil, where we were, or wherever, you can do things differently. And so I think you got to go into these different countries and understand what is the political atmosphere. At the same time, you need to understand what's the philanthropic atmosphere in Australia. Philanthropy there is strong and people unite. And you can take something like a Girls 20, as we did, to the Sydney Opera House. Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't happen in every country, right? I mean, imagine you've got these 20 young women from across the world. They're on the stage of the Sydney Opera House. Well, you're not going to get that everywhere. So I think it's really important to understand which country are you in? What is the different type of setup? What's the media like? What's the government like? What's the social profit world like? What's philanthropy like? How does business interact? And until you understand that, I don't know that it's really a good idea to try to navigate a country. I think I probably just went off topic, but I'm trying to sort of give you a sense of whatever country we went into, you had to go in with absolutely, first of all, don't make any conclusions unless you've got data to back it up. Don't think about a country a certain way because you've seen it a certain way until you were there, until you've spoken to people. Don't make any decisions, first of all. So my first phone call, my first visit, wherever possible, was always to go and meet with the ambassador from Canada to that country and say, what don't I know and what do I need to know? And that person was like gold, 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 gold.
Great question.
And so that's a resource, right, that people don't use. But I was like, how am I going to know? I'm not going to know who to go to and who to stay away from unless that ambassador or high commissioner or consul general takes the time to tell me. So I do think the one thing that sticks out in my mind is every single country was different. For Girls 20, when we went with Malala into different countries, every single country was different. You know, when you go into a place like Iraq and you're in Kurdistan and you're sitting with girls, their realities are very different in some ways than girls in Mexico. Yet they still share something that's the same. Mm-hmm. They still have the same ambitions. They're still looking for what they're going to do with their lives. They still have obstacles. But the way that you deal with all of that is different because their realities are different.
Yeah.
I think, Farah, the way you answered that is one of the reasons why you have been able to be such a successful leader as CEO of these incredible organizations like Malala Fund, Girls 20, Prince's Trust Canada, is because you have this quality of really listening and wanting to understand what is going on and not necessarily jumping first. And so, you know, we want to talk to you about leadership and executive leadership. I mean, what would you say is the most misunderstood thing about being a CEO?
Oh, I thought you were going to say the most misunderstood thing about being in the sector. No, I like this question. So first of all,
you can answer both of those questions.
I'll answer both, actually. First of all, can you guys come on and help me do my PR? Because you're really good for my ego. This has been fantastic.
Really like
Thank you.
This is
genuine. We're in the far
No, I know. But if you guys could, you know. Anyway, so I think the most misunderstood thing about being a CEO is I think people think that CEOs know everything. And the truth is we don't. You know, we are learning. We've got a lot of positive baggage with us. We have learned what to do that works, what not to do because it's not worked, but we are learning. We're in the process of listening. If you're a great leader, you're listening, you're learning, you're recalibrating. And so I think that's the biggest misunderstood thing. I think the other thing is that we don't feel our decisions. A CEO has to make a lot of tough decisions. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak for others, but when I'm making a decision that's impacting someone else, I feel it before, during, and long after.
Yeah.
And you hold on to that. And for some reason, you're not supposed to show emotion, which I think is bullshit. You know, and I think that's unfair. I think people see you in a way that is just not accurate. The biggest misconception of the sector is that we don't have the same standards. I still have a P&L. I have to report on how I've spent my money. If I'm 10% up or 10% down, I am accountable to a board.
Yeah.
And for those who feel that we don't have the same accountabilities, wrong, wrong, wrong. In fact, I would say that I'm held to a higher standard in some cases than many other businesses because these are donor dollars. And that's the thing that really gets me is people think, oh, it's the social profit. No, actually, there's a lot of pressure on the social profit to deliver far above what people would expect of a private sector because we don't have the same assets. We don't have the same reach sometimes. Whatever it is, we are innovators. We create things out of nothing. That's tough.
Yeah.
So, you know, I call bullshit.
Do you think, I'm sorry, Rachel, I'm hijacking this from our really well thought out interview guide, but I want to go with this for a second, Farah. So you're reminding me that we met when I was at Standard Chartered. So that was good long time ago. You've been in the sector for a while. Do you feel like that perception has changed? Has it evolved? In the time you've been in, do you think people are, because I agree with you, I do think that that is a huge misconception. And I'm thinking of what my own answer to that question would be, but I would love to know yours. Do you think in the time you have worked in the social profit sector, that's right, we're making it happen. Do you think that this perception of what kind of accountability these organizations have has changed?
I do. I don't know that it's changed enough, and I don't know that it's changed for enough people. But I think there are a couple things that have happened. One, there's a lot of money in the sector. So when you have people like Mackenzie Scott or Bill Gates or others who are well-known putting their money, people watch. People really eyes wide open, right? Mm-hmm. Accountability. Are you buying stuff or are you supporting stuff? And the language has changed. So I think that we've got a whole bunch of people who are business people who are now philanthropists. And that does change the game because other people are looking. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think there's a lot more transparency or expected transparency on donor dollars. So we do an annual report. We do regular quarterly reports to our donors. And so the system has changed also in terms of the expectations of the donor, forcing in some cases organizations to report differently. So I think the combination of different individuals getting into the space, the sort of the regimen of having to report certain ways at certain times, there's no slippage there. And then I think this whole thing about, you know, I am, and I think, well, every charitable entity in Canada has to report to CRA. And those are open reports. We don't get to hide who we get money from. We don't get to hide how we spend money. And so I do think there's a larger amount of transparency there. But, you know, for whatever reason, we walk around and call ourselves the third sector. Well, how do you want people to think about you then? If you think about the trillions of dollars and the thousands of jobs that exist in Canada alone around the sector we want to call charitable, you know, that's not money that just goes into the wind. We're all accountable for it. Yeah. So I do think there's change. I don't know that there's change enough where people actually understand that this sector is, it's also got business elements to it. And that's the problem, right? That's the problem is people don't see the amount of reporting and accountability that actually does exist in the system.
I hear you.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like every business person to go sit on a board of a social profit and then they'll see.
Yeah.
And then they can cut this stuff out where they're like, oh, well, so you're at a, you know, social profit. Like, no, I'm probably more accountable than you are as a senior vice president or something.
100%.
So obviously you've got me talking about something that really does get me.
Mm-hmm. Gauntlet thrown, business people. If you're not on a board,
there are a lot of good
social
people,
profit
right?
organization, what are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of amazing people who get it, who are in business, but there are enough of them who don't. And that's the problem.
Yeah, completely agree. We absolutely feel that in the UK as well. It's not just Canada. It's everywhere, mm-hmm. as we know.
This podcast is made possible by Siegel Family Foundation. We are building an extensive network of extraordinary people, positively transforming lives and communities across Africa. Whether you're a dreamer, funder, leader, or visionary, our network can help you make the greatest impact. To learn more, visit www.siegelfamilyfoundation.org or contact us at info@siegelfamilyfoundation.org.
Going back to your experience as a CEO, and I loved what you were saying around these misunderstood aspects that people don't think you feel your decisions. That's so good, the before, during, and after. And I'm wondering what your opinion is in terms of a leadership archetype, someone who is a CEO, and let's stick with the social profit sector for now, although perhaps your answer goes beyond it, and that's fine too. Do you think that there's an archetype of a certain type of person who is well-suited to executive leadership and specifically at the CEO level? And in line with that, what are your opinions on nature versus nurture? Do you think these people are born this way? You know, you're destined to be CEO, you have it in you from a young age, or do you think that these kinds of archetypes or key characteristics can be nurtured?
I'm smiling because my parents would tell you that it's born in you, because when I was 5 and we had no money and we were walking back from the grocery store and they gave me an empty bag, I was not interested in walking the 3 blocks. So apparently I put my hand out and I yelled for a taxi, and the taxi pulled over, and my parents, like, they had no money and they were like, we have to get in now. This is a pride thing. And so my parents love to tell that story to all of my friends. So now I've shared it, but my parents would tell you that it's probably a little bit of both, that it's mm-hmm. It's in you, and yeah. you have to have the right atmosphere to have it brought out in you, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm obviously answering your last question first, but I do think there's a mix of nurture and nature. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that if you're not born with it, you can never get there. Mm-hmm. But I think so much of it comes down to circumstance. Mm-hmm. And you see that around the world, right? You see where, and I'll, obviously my specialty is women, right? You see it in some countries where women are rising to the top because the community and the country is okay with it. They encourage it. They welcome it. They champion it. And there are other countries where you don't. So you can have someone who is really built for a CEO role or a leadership role, and they will never, ever reach that potential because the atmosphere does not allow for it.
Yeah.
So I do believe that nurture is a huge part of how we grow, support, move forward, find leaders. Mm-hmm. I really do. Mm-hmm. In terms of an archetype, look, I think it all depends on the organization at that time, right? You have startup entrepreneurial type of leaders. You have leaders who sort of tread water and make sure everything is going okay. You've got builders. You've got coaches. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there are people who are deal makers. I think there are so many. When I think about the roles that I've taken on, I know that I am not somebody who can tread water. I like to build. I like to create. I like to deal make. I like to, you know, really make sure that the kind of community I am building is one of an entrepreneurial mindset. Mm-hmm. So I actually don't think there is an archetype. I think there are many that are blended together, which is what actually makes a really good CEO or leader, is that they aren't just one particular type of person. Otherwise, you can't ebb and flow when things come up. And if you can't ebb and flow, you'll drown, right? I think one of the biggest things that a leader needs to know is how to prioritize. And there are times when you're going to have to just be a coach, and that's okay. That's what's needed. And there are times where you're going to say, you know what, this isn't working. You put your entrepreneurial hat on and you try to figure out what hat are you wearing that day. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to be willing to walk in and deal with whatever comes your way. And so I think if you only have one particular or a couple of different types of leadership qualities in you, you might make it for a little while, but I think it will be a very, very hard journey. Mm-hmm. You can't ebb and flow and pull those different types of leadership qualities out. You know, sometimes you just need to shut up and listen, right? You don't need to be the leader in the room with the loudest voice. You got to be the leader in the room with the biggest ears.
Mm-hmm.
I love hearing it described that way. There was this fight I used to have with my dad who argued because I had, at the time I had a boss who was a very difficult person. And my dad said, well, nobody gets to be a CEO unless they can be an asshole. And I was like, that cannot possibly be true. And we used to have this battle all the time where we would like send each other articles back and forth. And now, like 10 years on, he has said to me, oh no, I never said that. I'm like, you did.
Rachel with the recorder then.
You did. But there is also this changing face of what a leader looks like and acts like. And, you know, I think that our horizons for what leadership actually entails has broadened as we've had, what is it, like less CEOs named that are women that are named John or whatever the stat is. But, you know, it's still an appalling stat, but actually it's better than it was. And I think as there has become more space to appreciate different types of leadership, then that has also opened up our eyes to what a leader could look like or be. And I think that's a very promising development.
Yeah, that's such a, I mean, first of all, hi, Dad. Second of all, I think your dad, not mine.
My parents are so used to me throwing them under the bus now for a podcast interview.
But I think that's a fair assessment of what a CEO used to look and act like.
Yeah.
And now I think, you know, look, one of the hardest things about being a CEO is that you have to understand that not everyone's going to love you. Mm-hmm. And that's tough in and of itself, right? Everyone wants to be liked. Well, not everyone. I mean, there are a few people I won't mention because we're not being political, but everyone sort of has that, I think, where people, they want people to like them. They want people to respect them and like them, and they don't want to come across as a, you know, a jerk. But not everyone's going to feel that way because not everyone's going to agree with you. Mm-hmm. They're not going to agree with your decisions, and they're not going to agree with the path that you took. And you have to, that's, I guess, one thing that every leader has to have is you have to be okay with that. Mm-hmm. And if you can't be okay with that, then you probably can't be a leader. And that's not specific to the social profit sector. That's to any sector. It doesn't matter if you're running a small business or a massive multinational enterprise, or you're, you know, the prime minister or president, or you're the member of parliament. If you can't take the criticism and people not liking what you've done or how you think or how you act, then don't put yourself in the firing line.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Speaking of leadership styles changing, you know, the tides changing and these new models of what being a leader can look like. And I completely agree with your last point as well, with all of them around on even having the capacity to hold that criticism and to think strategically about what parts you want to keep and what parts you don't. I want to talk about generational differences.
Aha, the age question.
Exactly. We're getting...
Here we go.
Okay, so now we've done politics. We've done...
kind of religion.
Yeah,
kind of.
And
we've done age. All
here right. we go. Look,
now we've ticked all the boxes.
Well, and I've talked about height, so, you know.
Perfect. Perfect. There's something for everyone on this episode.
Exactly. That's so true. And we want to get, you know, this topic, generational differences, is quite a juicy one. And it's a really interesting one. I know we've spoken about it before. And you've had this amazing career where a really key kind of motif in it has been youth leadership, you know, championing youth voices, Malala Fund, girls' education, girls 20, putting young women in the center of decision-making spaces. So this idea of youth leadership is really, feels kind of core to the narrative of the legacy that you've built and are building. And yet, these days, talk to anyone on a podcast or especially off a podcast, and you ask them about generational differences, and you bring up Gen Z, you know, the people who are in their 20s these days, and people have a lot of opinions. There's definitely a lot of friction, a lot of misunderstanding, you know, different attitudes, different mindsets towards the idea of work, the idea of labor, the idea of leadership, et cetera. And so I'm wondering, if, you know, if someone's listening to this, and let's say they're in their early 20s, they're sort of, you know, a young Gen Z, and they have leadership aspirations, maybe they do want to be a social profit CEO or a leader in a different kind of context. What would you want to say to this emerging leader who's listening? What advice would you give them?
So I guess the first thing I would say is, this is such a tough one, Rachel, because first of all, I hope my team will listen to this. And I hope that whatever I say comes across in absolutely the right way. I think there's this tendency, and we all did it. Like, I remember when I was in my 20s, I was in such a hurry. Everything needed to be done. The expectations, you could not manage my expectations. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I would say to myself, so I'll say it to generations now, is slow it down a little bit. Manage your expectations. Don't expect that everything's going to come fast and furious. If you're in a job for 3 months, you're probably not going to get a promotion at March 6 months, right? It's you got to really manage expectations, and you got to know that not everything can be 100% transparent the way you want it to be. Leaders make tough decisions, and sometimes those decisions have to be made behind closed doors and for privacy reasons or whatever. You know, there's a tendency for, I think, this generation to want to know all of it and for decisions to be made flat. And as much as I would love to do that, it's just not possible. So understanding the system, I think, is really important. Really understanding the system. Understand why there's hierarchy. Understand why some decisions are being made behind closed doors. And don't take it personally. Mm-hmm. It's not a reflection on you as to why you're not in every single room. I struggle with this a lot because I don't lead by consensus, but I do consult. So I think it's important. And the reason I like to have the type of team I have today is because they are so diverse. They're so interesting. They've got such incredible backgrounds. They're different ages and stages, different backgrounds. Some of them I don't even have not even peeled the onion back, and you can tell, right? Mm-hmm. But with all of those differences, three things I would say to them is, please understand that making decisions is harder than it looks, and it's more complicated than it may seem. That's the first thing. Second, because you don't know everything doesn't mean that people are trying to hide something. That's really important. And the third part is, there's a beauty to open communication. And understand that people are listening, but it's also important to know when to stop. Like, voice your opinion for sure, but we're not punching bags. And I'm not saying this about my team. I have a friend right now who's going through a very difficult leadership moment. And this person's team is really expecting a lot of them. And when they don't get it, they go back and back and back. And I'm watching this person and I'm thinking, he is not going to stay if this continues to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's losing a leader, because the person's trying to be open and honest, but it's not being met with that same openness and honesty. So it is a two-way road. I really do love the way my team feels very comfortable, I hope, coming and voicing their concerns. I love it. I learn from it. There are things I haven't thought about that they help me understand. Because as I said, I'll go back to the misconceptions, is we don't know everything. We learn by listening. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't created an atmosphere where your team can speak to you, then shame on you, right? Having an open door policy actually means having an open door policy, that you're going to hear stuff you don't want to hear. But for that new generation of leaders, managing expectations is massive. Mm. And it's better for them, and they won't be as disappointed, right? When things don't move as fast and as furiously as they want to. The last thing I would say is, you know, don't feel afraid to put your hand up. If you don't trust your leader to put your hand up, then get the hell out of that job. Mm-hmm. Find a better place where you can put your hand up and not worry about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Right? If you truly want to be a leader one day, go find somebody who is a leader that you want to be like. Mm-hmm. Don't be in an office and learn bad habits and think that that's okay. That's not okay. People who yell at their staff, that's not okay. People who berate their staff, that's not okay. People who want their staff to work like crazy and not reward them, that's not okay. None of those behaviors are okay. And it doesn't matter which generation it is. I laugh at myself for the way we worked in politics. Ridiculous. 18-hour days, 7 days a week. But I wouldn't give it up, because it taught me stuff that I still have today. And that was my choice, right? I was addicted to politics. But it's up to everyone to find their place. And if you're in a place that does not match your values or the type of people you want to work with, get the hell out of there. Go find something that will allow you to soar. You got one life, right? You got one journey. So, and you're the master of it.
That's so beautiful. I'm just wondering if we should invent like a role that's like president/prime minister of Canada, the UK, and the US, like at one time, and then you can run.
Oh, wow.
I guess that used to be called king or queen. So maybe we shouldn't go back to that.
No, maybe we shouldn't. No,
that's true. I'm just saying, I'll put you in charge.
No.
Farah, we could talk to you all day because we love talking to you. We will talk to you in unrecorded forms, but this has been so amazing. Besides our new vocabulary word of social profit, what is one thing you would really like our listeners who are kind of widely spread out across the social profit sector to take away from this conversation?
Well, look, I haven't had a chance to say too much about where I am right now, but I am the CEO of soon to be called the King's Trust Canada. April 2nd, the name will change. And, you know, I'm proud to work here because I do believe this is an organization that really cares about the journey of buried youth. We have tons of people in Canada. We have 860,000 young people who are not in employment, education, or training. They're called to meet. King's Trust Canada is committed to helping at least 100,000 of them over the next 10 years find employment. And that means we got to think differently. We got to be open to young people who have different paths. And the one thing I would say is we want to have leaders. If we want to have really good leaders, we got to look everywhere for them. And that's about supporting barriered youth who don't necessarily have those opportunities. So I would say keep doing what you guys are doing because you're helping people think differently about leadership. And if you continue to do that, then young people who are coming up the pipeline in different ways will find those opportunities. So I am really thrilled to be part of this. I love talking to you guys. You've really made me think about how I show up. And I'm a work in progress, so I do appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Farah. Wow, what a note to end on. Thank you for your time. It's really an honor to speak with you always and to have this kind of conversation about these bigger topics and leadership. It's just such a nice space to have together. So thank you.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks for tuning in and hope you loved the conversation with Farah and Alicia. As always, we'd love to connect with you. You can find us on LinkedIn at IG Advisors. Our website is impactandgrowth.com. And this is where you can find all the details about our new program, Impact and Grow, a Leadership Lab. As a reminder, the applications are due by May 3rd and we kick off on May 20th. And finally, we have our fellowship website where we run the Fix the Flow Fellowship, and that's at fixtheflow.org. Of course, another thank you to our official sponsor, Siegel Family Foundation, and to our media partner, Alliance Magazine. Don't forget, you can use the code WHATDONORSWANT, all one word, for 50% off an Alliance subscription. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.
This podcast was produced by me, Rachel Stephenson-Sheff, and the team at Scrubcast. Shout out to Dave and Tim. Please rate, review, and subscribe if you can. It really helps us do what we do. Thanks so much.